I would love to start at the beginning of this incredible museum of how it came to be. What is the history of how this place began, why it exists?
It was founded by people from the former resistance in the 1980s. At that moment, they were most of the time quite young, retired, had a lot of time, and a small right-wing political parties were emerging. So they felt an urge to start a museum to educate the children what had happened during World War II and to warn. So this shouldn't happen ever again. So the museum opened in 1985 on another location in the southern part of Amsterdam. It was quite small and it was a difficult location because it was, well, a living area. Not so many tourists were coming there or people walking by. And so in 1999, we moved to this place. And since then, the museum is, well, booming. It's the visitors numbers are growing. And yes, the museum is doing very well. And we renewed our permanent exhibition about the Netherlands during World War II recently, in a few years ago. And last year, we renewed our department about the Dutch colonies during World War II.
How did you get involved?
Well, I did study history in the 80s, and it was very hard to find a job in those times. There was a lot of unemployment. And so I started as a volunteer. And after 1 year of volunteering, I got small jobs in the museum, and I got also jobs in other museums. And after a few years, I became the curator. And in 2003, I became the director. So that's also already quite a long time. But I've been involved since December 1989.
What about this place resonated with you? Why did this place, this organization and its mission matter?
Well, I think, you know, when I started here, the people of the resistance were very active in the museum, because at that time the museum had two paid employees, and the rest were all volunteers, and most of them were from the resistance. And I really, well, I liked them. I became very attached to them, because resistance is about taking your own responsibility and to act. The people did it not because they had to. There was not a formal structure. They did it from the bottom of their hearts. And they were people who respected me as a young girl. I was at the time a young girl. They respected me because they are not thinking in status, or that's not their way of doing, because of the fact that they resisted. And so that's how I came involved. And I think that's what I think is important. We show in the museum that it's not easy to resist when you are living under a dictatorship, and you are, you have to accept that maybe you will be executed, or so. It's quite a risk, and we show that it's understandable that some of the people didn't resist. but it showed that there are people who do and who stand up against dictatorship and persecution of minorities. And that's an important message also for nowadays.
Yeah. I'd like to go back in time a little bit. And you fill in the gaps where I'm wrong. But my understanding is that some dates that really matter, May 1940, the invasion occurs here. And in short order, the Germans have occupied the country. I'd love to have you just take that date and that moment and run with it in whatever direction you think matters as it relates to the resistance movement. What happened at that time in 1940 in the spring? This is 85 years ago now.
Mm-hmm.
That led to the resistance movement. What led to the invasion itself? Anything that you think would be interesting to the general public? I'd love to have you share.
Yeah, well, of course, in all over Europe, democracy was declining.
Yeah.
In Spain, there was Franco, in Italy, Mussolini, in Germany, our neighbor country, Hitler. So there was Poland was invaded in 1939. So there was a lot of international tension. But the Netherlands hoped. They were neutral, officially neutral, and they hoped that they could stay out of the conflict because that was the case during World War One, the Great War. Mm. And so a lot of people, well, they knew there was a lot of trouble, but when the Nazi Germany invaded on the 10th of May 1940, they were very surprised and very shocked. And they thought, well, terrible things will happen. But the Germans wanted to win over the Dutch people for National Socialism. They saw the Dutch as a German brother, German brotherhood people.
Yeah.
And so they, Seyss Inquart, who was the highest Nazi in the occupied Netherlands, he tried to be a reconciliation, verzoening.
He tried to ingratiate himself with the Dutch people.
Oh, yes, he tried to appease the Dutch people.
Yep.
Reconciliation.
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 Yeah.
Yeah. He tried. He held a speech and he said, "Well, nobody has to worry. We will not change your ways. We will not change the country. We will respect you." And in the beginning, the occupiers behaved polite in the streets and they paid their groceries. And so it wasn't too bad in the beginning. And there wasn't also much to resist to at that moment.
Mm.
And so the people were awaiting, but, well, they didn't like the occupation. And then there are slowly all kinds of measures and beginning of resistance, and it evolves very slowly. The ones who manifested themselves in the beginning were especially the Dutch Nazis. There was a small group of Dutch Nazis. And they started also to, the Dutch Nazis started to provocate the Jews in Amsterdam.
Yeah, to provoke them.
To provoke them. And of course, the German Nazis hoped that it would give reactions of violence. And so they could
Start the fire.
Yes, and they could blame the Jews.
Yeah.
That was the purpose. Those provocations led to the death of one of the Dutch Nazis. And by accident, a German patrol was sprayed with gas in all the riots which were around here in Amsterdam. And then they did have their first big razzia. They rounded up over 400 young men. And they expected Dutch would accept it. But then there was an enormous general strike in Amsterdam, the February strike, 1941. Okay. And it started by the communists, but it was taken over much broader. And that strike was, repressed. This strike was repressed very harshly.
Yeah.
So people were shot to death on the streets, and there were death sentences, and all mayors had to be were replaced. A lot of people were fired. So at that moment, the resistance started to evolve.
So this is February 1941. So
yes,
this is less than a year after the invasion itself. This is not 8-9 months after the invasion.
And before there also were measures. There were registration measures, but they were obeyed. The Dutch people were accepting. They used to accept. Here I am again. Authority. The Dutch people were used to accept authority. They were used to listen to the figure in the church, the mayor. So they didn't have any history of resistance. Where was I?
I think that, so there is this, my understanding from just going through the tour is that there was this massive enrollment in this national identity cards, right? Where everyone had to put their name and address and information.
Yeah, that's
on it.
Later.
Okay.
Yeah.
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 So the general strike.
That's why I told it. The first measures to registrate the Jewish people were widely accepted. But at the moment that Jews were rounded up, then the February strike broke out. And that was kind of wake up. But it also made that the people didn't dare anymore.
Because of the brutality of the punishment by the Germans.
Yes.
What do you make of the reason why the strike happened in the first place? As I think you mentioned this, that it was led by the Communist Party. It was all over the country. Was it really?
Well, not all over the country.
Various places.
Especially, it started in Amsterdam, and it spread the second day to surrounding cities and villages.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was it really based in a concern for the well-being of fellow Jewish citizens? How do you explain the uprising, the initial resistance at that time in February of 1941?
Yeah, there is a discussion about it.
Yeah.
It's definitely partly because of the shock of this great rounding up of 400 innocent Jewish boys. But the communists had the strike as a mean of
an
organized uprising. They had an idea also longer. But the rounding up of the Jews was was the moment they thought now it's the moment to do it.
Yeah.
And it also was the reason that a lot of people joined.
So there is this strike. There is the pushback to the strike, the violent pushback to the strike. We're getting into the territory of history that I think a lot of Americans certainly know about from stories of, from Amsterdam of major oppression of the Jews. I'd love for you to fill in whatever gaps make sense between February of 1941 and outright deportation, outright murder. What's the story that leads from there to a year or two later?
Yeah. In the period in between... The Nazis still tried to win over the Dutch for National Socialism, especially with a lot of propaganda. And also with taking over organizations. So they placed Dutch Nazis in charge of all kinds of Dutch organizations. So they tried to impose the National Socialism.
The ideology.
The ideology and the leading of the country in this way. But they did succeed on some part. Sometimes it succeeded, sometimes it didn't. And the anti-Jewish measures were taken by very small steps. So first the Jewish people were not allowed to come into parks and swimming pools, and then there were separate schools. And then in May 1942, they had to wear the yellow star on all their clothes. And then in July, the deportation started. And so it was a kind of sneaky by small steps to prevent resistance. Also prevent resistance among the Jewish community itself. And you have to keep in mind, people thought that the liberation would be quite soon. So
let's wait it out.
Let's wait it out. We'll see. We will be liberated soon. And that's forgotten nowadays often.
Yeah.
When the Jewish people had to report for deportation, it was told to them it was for work, and there was a list, and you had to take working boots and a blanket and so on. So it sounded quite normal. Okay, we have to work in a camp, and there were rumors about mass murder, and some people believed it, but a lot of people couldn't believe it. So there was also a lot of discussion. But also little babies, very old people had to go. So, well, it was quite clear that a terrible fate awaited them.
You mentioned the propaganda that was subtly introduced into the culture. I don't know if it's worth talking about that, but what do we know about how they tried to brainwash, how they tried to influence the minds, the hearts and minds of the people who lived here to fall in line with the belief system of the Nazi regime?
Yeah, they tried they had a measure. They blamed the Jewish people for all kinds of things, and they repeated it all over again in the hope that people would believe it. So they also, you know, the Netherlands fought during the 17th and 18th centuries wars with England. So they went into the history and said, well, England is, Britain is our enemy. Then it was our enemy and now it's our enemy again. In that way, they tried all kinds of tricks to convince the people, but not very successful.
I'd love for you to correct me where I'm wrong about this, but I believe I just read in my view of the museum, you were talking about when the Jews began to be put on these trains and deported, forcibly deported. I believe I read that it was a weekly train on a Monday night, and the list would be revealed, you know, hours before people were required to get on and leave be taken into Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that's...
I don't know if that's your understanding.
That's okay. That's correct. But that was in the Camp Westerbork. So first the Jews had to live in the same neighborhoods in the cities, and then they were brought to Camp Westerbork. It's in the east of the Netherlands, and that was a transit camp. And from there, the weekly train did go to the concentration camps Sobibor and Auschwitz. And yes, it's correct that it was a very tense situation. Is your name on the list? People try to make themselves very useful in Camp Westerbork, so they hope their names wouldn't be on the list. Yes, that's correct.
I'd love to take a quick tangent and talk about Amsterdam a little bit historically. And this is just my biased perspective of the city, knowing a little bit about the history of the Enlightenment, the history of Western ideas, the place of Amsterdam in history of being a sanctuary for minority opinion, for minorities in general. Spinoza lived here at a time when he was fleeing a bunch of other nations. When I hear stories about the Dutch people not falling for the propaganda as readily as was expected or hoped by the Nazi Party, I know there were 170,000 Jews, I think, who were integrated into this civilization.
Yeah,
you know, my bias, not knowing nearly as much as you do about this history, is that this is a unique historic location for diversity and tolerance. And perhaps that is related to the resistance, the lack of widespread adoption of propaganda in general. I don't know if there's anything you want to say about that, or maybe you disagree. I'm sure it's more nuanced and complicated than I understand, but I just wanted to put that to you as an idea.
Yeah. Yeah. The Netherlands started to be an independent country by resisting their landlord, who was at the moment also the king of Spain, and he was Roman Catholic, and many Dutch people became Protestant. And you see this also in all over Germany, that Protestantism is emerging. So it started by an uprising. So that's maybe why they are tolerant, is because they also always had a big Roman Catholic minority, not even a minority. I think half of the population stayed Roman Catholic. But the Protestants were dominant. Officially, this was until the Enlightenment and the period of the French Revolution, it was officially the only allowed religion, but they tolerated Catholic churches, Jewish churches, Armenian, all kinds of groups were allowed to live in the country, and especially in Amsterdam. That's also because it was the people from Amsterdam gained their money mainly by trading, and they were very well, when it was in their interest, they didn't care that much.
Yeah.
To tolerate things.
Hmm.
They were really,
they're business people.
They were business people. Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. I'd love to go into some of the details of the extraordinarily dark and probably the best known components of the occupation. Obviously, I mean, it's impossible as a visitor to even get a ticket to go to the Anne Frank house. And I think she still resonates. I live in New York City, and there's, I think, a exact replica there now because it's so popular for people to visit and remember the story. And I don't know if her experience is generally emblematic of the Jewish hiding experience in Amsterdam during the Second World War, but I'd love to just put it to you to share whatever has resonated in your mind about what it was like to be a Jewish person living through the beginning of the occupation, and especially when the crackdown started to become, and I don't know if it was caused by a knowledge that we either go into hiding and risk our lives that way, or we're basically destined to go be sent off to one of these camps, or if there were other options that they had. But I'd love for you to share whatever you think matters about those moments in probably the 1942-43 years when things began to get extremely dangerous.
Yeah, people had to decide, will I go into hiding? And or not, and some of the people decided really conscious to do not to do so. I knew someone who took his guitar to the camps. He had a vision that it was quite innocent there. What was important, and it was also the case with the Frank family, that in the beginning they had to take the initiative to go into hiding themselves. And it helped if there was money. Of course, Otto Frank, he could organize it himself. But all of the people needed the help of non-Jewish people. And for Otto Frank, at the best, were mainly his employees who helped. Some people didn't have non-Jewish friends or acquaintances, didn't have any money. And for them, it was very hard to find a place to go into hiding. So in that sentence, the story of Anne Frank is a good example that they took their initiative and partly organized it themselves. But it's quite exceptional that a family could stay together. Most of the time, Jewish families had to be separated and go to several addresses because many people who were prepared to help Jewish people had a place for one or two. And for children, it always was it was easier to find a place for children than for grown-ups. But that people stay together with a family is quite exceptional. So going into hiding was also to take the hard decision to go apart and not know whether you would see each other again. And that also was a reason for some people not going into hiding. We'd rather stay together in the camp than now find places for all of us independently to go into hiding. So there were practical decisions, and also it was a difficult decision to not stay together anymore.
For families like the Franks who decided to stay together and had the means to
and
stay
had
together.
And had the means, yeah, because they had to, he had his factory. And,
it was his business, right? It was his business
and the place where they made the jam. And there was a place where they could stay together. And
Did families like that always create some story that was told about how they had fled? What do we know about how people tried to disguise what they were actually doing?
Yes, they sometimes they organized that someone sent a postcard from Switzerland or whatever. So they hoped that the Nazis, well, they were fled to Switzerland. And they spread stories that they, most of the time, they tried to convince other people that they were fled out of the country to Switzerland.
Yeah. You mentioned this earlier, and I've thought about this for many years, about I think most people would like to believe that they would be someone who would have the courage to help in a moment like that. And I think you mentioned earlier, it's difficult to blame people who struggle with that or don't do it because they're risking immediate execution in some circumstances if they decide to go do it. It's easy in retrospect to think you would be the one to do it. The Nazis were going to lose the war and you would be celebrated as a hero, but no one knew that at the time, definitively. What do we know about, just percentages-wise, how many, what percentage of the Dutch population was actively involved in resistance, either in helping Jews hide, helping to feed Jews, arming a resistance movement, writing in opposition, really putting their life on the line in those years?
Yes. Well, first of all, it develops in little steps.
Yeah.
And what's also is important that in the spring 1943, all the Dutch men had to go to Germany for forced labor after the defeat in Stalingrad.
Yeah.
All the Dutch, the German soldiers had to fight in the army. They needed people to work and in the agriculture and in the war industry. And at that moment, all of the Dutch people were affected. And at that moment, a lot of people went into hiding and reinforced resistance. So they were affected themselves.
They were implicated directly.
Directly.
Yeah.
And so if you say resistance in 1942 or resistance in 1944... it's
different.
Not comparable, almost not comparable. And it was all informal. It was not written down how it was organized. It was not, it was all, kind of, all the resistance groups were, all had a lot of overlap, and so it's very hard to talk about numbers. Often it's said about in the second half of the occupation period, about 10% was in active resistance. Could be true around. Maybe,
when you say
maybe more, but
second half, that's 19, what year is that?
After spring 1943.
Okay. Then after the
grew.
Conscription.
Yeah, then yeah, it okay. grew. Yeah. It grew. But that is about the full-time resistance, and a lot of people supported the resistance. If they didn't have to take a risk, they supported resistance. And that also was kind of, well, they were the most of the people were really anti-Nazi. so they wouldn't betray betray people in hiding.
Hmm.
For instance, also Anne Frank, you know, there was a research who betrayed Anne Frank. And not so long after the war, they asked all of the neighbors what they knew. And almost everyone knew there were people in hiding there. They had noticed this, but they didn't risk their lives by not talking about it.
Yeah, many could have, but they didn't.
They didn't.
Mm.
Most of them didn't. Mm. Didn't. So that's also important. But really, yeah, risking your life, not everyone dared to do it.
Mm.
And you see that many people in the resistance were young students.
Mm.
They were well organized. They were financial independent in those days from rich families. Mm. Didn't have a family, didn't have children yet. So they were the ones who could do it.
Mm.
And, many other people didn't do it because they didn't want to risk their own children, for instance. And the ones who did were sometimes blamed by their children afterwards because, well, you choose for resistance, but that meant you neglected us and when they were executed, it's quite a trauma.
Yeah, there's no father around.
There's no father around, and he didn't choose me. He chose the resistance, and he chose the risk to die.
Yeah.
And so it's understandable that not everyone, dared to resist.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I saw downstairs that there... out of something like 170,000 Jews in the Netherlands, 105,000 died.
Mm-hmm.
So most Jews died during the Holocaust in the Second World War who lived here. You said before we started recording that you're going to be working on a biography of a man. I think you called him the most famous Dutch resistance fighter.
Mm-hmm.
Who is this person? And what's his story?
Gerrit van der Veen.
Hmm.
He worked as a sculptor. And he had a lot of Dutch friends and family. His sister was married to a Jewish guy, and he was very much opposed to the occupation itself, the fact that one country occupies another country. And he also was very affected by the persecution of the Jews. So the first measure against the Jews was that they had to leave there was an organization, how do you call it? Well, never mind. I can skip that. You know, I told that the Nazis tried to impose their National Socialism over a Dutch organization.
Hmm.
And he was an artist, a sculptor. And when they started to organize a Nazi organization for artists, he objected.
Hmm.
That's why he had to go into hiding. And then he started to make, first of all, for the people who, the artist who didn't want to join this Nazi organization, he started to make fake IDs.
Mm.
The Germans started this very good identity card, which was very harsh. To fake.
Yeah.
And he started a big organization to fake these cards. And But a problem was that he together with a bigger group, he managed to make good falsifications. Mm. But a problem stayed that the names and all was very well registered at the National Registration mm-hmm. Office. And then he starts with a group also, we should blow up this registration office to destroy.
Which is essentially a national, as I understand it, a national database.
It's a national database from before
where.
The war.
Exactly.
But it was registered, what was your belief? You know, the Protestant, Roman Catholic, or the Jewish.
Yeah.
They called it Nederlands Israelitisch. And also the age, which was important later on for the boys who had to work in Germany. So they tried to destroy that that registration office, which is by accident opposite to the museum,
really?
The building. And it was quite a success, but later on it appeared that there was another registration in The Hague. So much of it could be restored. But anyway, he was a quite effective resistance fighter who became involved more and more and more. And he did have a family, and he did have two daughters, and they also had to go into hiding when they were quite young. And he was executed in June 1944. And so it's quite a dramatic story with a long aftermath.
Amazing. He was executed because they had discovered he had destroyed this registry, and they knew that.
Yes,
he
did more than that. He did. He was caught when he tried to release his comrades who were in prison. So he did a lot of. He did much more than what I just told you.
He was very involved.
Hmm. Yeah, he also had an illegal newspaper for artists who wanted to resist, and he was very involved.
The fake IDs that he was making, if done successfully, those would allow people to leave the country? What primarily would it help people with?
You were not allowed to go out to the country anyway during the occupation. And then you needed a passport, and this was an identity card. And it was used by the occupiers to control the Dutch population and to ban out the Jews. So by the Jews, a big J was stamped in it. There was a lot of controlling of these IDs in the streets. It was a way of controlling the people.
Yeah,
it was not a document for traveling.
Okay,
traveling was not allowed.
They were illegal.
If you wanted to, if Jews wanted to flee to Switzerland, it was an illegal route through all occupied Belgium and France, and it was very stressful and hard journey. It was also a little organized, escape groups organized.
Like an underground railroad?
No, not that. But there were, for instance, and also to Spain, by the way. Franco was in Spain, but it was a neutral country. It was not involved in the Second World War. So there were still Dutch diplomats in Spain, and they could help you get to sometimes the Dutch colonies in the beginning, or to Switzerland.
So the fake IDs were mostly designed to try to help resist against internal harassment and persecution against Jews.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because the as a Jew or as a resistance fighter, as someone who took risk, You needed a fake identity card.
Yeah. I should have asked this earlier, but the amount, I think you said he had family who were Jewish himself. How integrated was the Jewish community in places like Amsterdam before the war started? I mean, was it like modern Amsterdam, modern New York City? What was the situation like as Jews were regarded at that time?
Yeah, they were quite integrated.
Yeah.
And that's why many of them felt safe. They were quite integrated. There were a lot of Jewish people in the socialist movement, some of them in the communist movement. And, well, yeah, there was a lot of them married to non-Jewish people. It was quite integrated,
You said when we first started the conversation that you knew a lot of these resistance figures personally, and that you liked them a lot. What kind of qualities do you remember them possessing? What did you like about them?
What I think is important, they were independent thinking, critical independent thinking. And they were, very direct, most of them. And I think that's most important. And of course, they never saw themselves as heroes. Never. So for me, I don't see them as heroes because I grew up with them, and I didn't want to be seen as heroes.
The last question I'd love to ask you, and it's about why this place exists in part. I mean, you said this earlier that they wanted, as there was an increase in, I think you said, the far right parties gaining power, they wanted to build something like this as probably a form of resistance, or at least an example for young people to come and know about the threat of extreme political parties. We're talking in the summer of 2025. Why does this place still matter? You know, if either to you or to the people who started this, what's enduringly important about this place for humanity in general?
Yeah, I think it's very important nowadays because we see that democracy and a rule of law are not taken for granted anymore. And they are declining in Europe, in the USA as well. You know, I can imagine people who always lived in a country which is quite prosperous, and they take democracy for granted, they take rule of law for granted, and they are... they get a kind of anti-elite atmosphere, thinking, why don't they do it better? Because it's not easy. And you need rules and to organize a democracy. And those real rules are not always convenient. But they are necessary if you want to live together with a big group of people. Some people think, well, let's get rid of democracy. Maybe a dictatorship will be better. And what you also see is that they blame the foreigners and they blame the refugees. That's the same kind of reaction she saw before the war. I think people can learn from the museum that dictatorship is never a good alternative. Never. I hope that people learn that from our museum.
Yeah, I think that's a good place to stop. Thank you so much for doing this.
You're welcome.